Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Second Court of Appeals. We only have one case set for oral argument this morning, and it is you. Your panel today is, to my right, Justice Mark Pittman, to my left, Justice Wade Birdwell, and I am Lee Gabriel. If the clerk will call the case.
The court will now call the defendant, P.E. And may it please the court, Mr. Stephen Dubner to argue for the appellant, P.E. and A.E. And Ms. Mary Wardley to argue for the appellee, A.E. All right.
Mr. Dubner.
May it please the court. Good morning. My name is Stephen Dubner. I'm here on behalf of the appellants who are H.E. and A.E., and they are the parents of A.E., and they are actually sitting in the courtroom behind me in the first row. If A.E. does not need a guardian, then it would be very difficult to imagine a situation where anybody would need a guardian appointed. We're here today as the voice of the people who cannot make their own decisions. The facts of this case are very clear and they're uncontroverted. A.E. is intellectually disabled. She has an IQ somewhere between the neighborhood of 35 and 50. She is not going to approve. She has difficulty communicating. She cannot break down complex tasks into simple tasks. She can't manage a bank account. She can't make financial decisions. She can't determine her residence. She cannot operate a motor vehicle, and she doesn't have the capacity to vote in a public election. She also doesn't have the capacity to make educational decisions. She's unable to consent to medical conditions, medical treatment, and in fact, the parents believe that AE will actually refuse medical treatment. She's unable to read or understand a complex legal document, even if somebody were to explain it to her. And she also has a tendency to answer yes to pretty much all the questions she's asked. She's a pleaser, and her answer to questions is almost always yes. The only medical testimony we had in this case was from Dr. Elhintz. And Dr. Elhintz concluded that AE is totally incapacitated, that she's unable to handle decisions for herself, even with assistance, that she does not have the capacity to sign a POA, either a medical power of attorney or a durable power of attorney, or even what's called a supported decision-making agreement under the new statutes that went into effect in September of 2015. In fact, Dr. Elhintz indicated that she would not honor a power of attorney because she does not believe that AE has the capacity to sign such document. Now, AE does not, according to Dr. Elhintz, does not have the capacity to provide informed consent to treatment, meaning that she cannot, AE cannot understand the risk and hazards of a procedure, even if someone attempted to explain it to her. And as a result, Dr. Elhintz indicated that she may be required to withhold treatment because she does not have that informed consent.
If she's presented with a medical power of an attorney that's been signed by AE giving these medical power of attorney to her parents, does the doctor have any discretion not to treat AE?
The doctor under the new statute for a durable power of attorney has to follow it, but in this case under a medical power of attorney, I believe the doctor does have discretion not to follow it. The doctor has already indicated that she does not believe that AE has the capacity to sign the document to begin with. So yes, I believe that she does have the discretion not to follow it and has already stated that she would do such. Now, the doctor also indicated that she believes that AE will be susceptible to abuse. Now, the court in its findings concluded that AE was incapacitated, although the court denied a guardianship, even though the court investigator, through cross-examination, admitted that she would have to recommend the guardianship based on the facts that she heard at the trial court level on that day. Now, there's a number of errors that we believe the trial court made. The first one, we believe the trial court abused its discretion by not finding that AE was totally incapacitated. The evidence at the trial was that AE cannot do anything for herself, that she is totally without capacity to care for herself or to manage her property as defined under the Estates Code 1101.151. So we believe the facts support the fact that AE is a totally incapacitated person. We also believe the trial court abused its discretion by not finding it's in AE's best interest to have a court appoint a guardian for her. And the reason is without a guardian, there is nobody who can determine AE's residence. There's nobody with authority to consent to either medical or dental treatment. There's nobody with authority to consent to AE's employment. There's nobody with authority to make educational decisions for AE. And it doesn't make a lot of sense to leave AE with a bunch of rights that she's not capable of exercising, and in fact, can't exercise those rights to her detriment. Without a guardian, she'll also be denied governmental benefits. And there are benefits to having a guardian. There's court oversight. There are court visitors. The guardians who are appointed are watched by the court. They have to file annual reports each year. They also have to notify the court in the future if there's a lesser restrictive alternative that does become available. So we believe that there was also evidence to support the exploitation and abuse. So we believe the trial court did abuse its discretion by not finding it's in AE's best interest to have a guardian. We also believe it's
as though the trial court's hanging its hat on these support and services that are available. Why is it that you don't believe that the support and services are adequate?
Well, the supports and services by definition under the statute, the individual, in this case it would be AE, has to be able to make those decisions. There's no authority for a non-guardian to make decisions on behalf of AE. Now, supports and services, Judge King in the probate court number one here in Tarrant County, he has a list of things that he believes are supports and services. Those are things like Meals on Wheels, perhaps volunteer services, adult daycare, but somebody still has to be able to consent to these services, and AE does not have that capacity. So by definition, supports and services are not applicable and do not work. I think it's also important to remember that we did have an ad litem in the case who looked at all this, who represented to the court that there are no supports and services available. Plus, the supports and services do not allow somebody to make residential decisions for AE. They do not allow her to allow them to make decisions regarding marriage. They do not allow them to make decisions regarding operating a motor vehicle, making decisions regarding voting, or even making decisions about employment. So without a guardian, there is nobody to even consent to support and services to the extent they would even be applicable for AE's care.
Okay, is there a distinction in the law between an individual who can be characterized medically as totally incapacitated as opposed to someone who has a degree of incapacity or a degree of incompetence? And because it appears that your argument is, based upon your presentation of the evidence, is that AE is totally incapacitated when it comes to making decisions about her life, okay? And therefore, as a result, she can't ever be in a position to make an actual decision that impacts her, whether it is to sign a medical power of attorney, whether it is to decide to herself to undergo certain treatment. Counsel appears to concede that in her brief, that there's a total incapacity, but did the trial court make a total incapacity finding or only a general incapacity finding that leaves us kind of in a limbo as to whether or not we're dealing with total or partial incapacity, a degree of incapacity, and how are we to deal with that from the record? Are you just going to say she's totally incapacitated and that's why you end up with us wanting a reversal and rendition, that there's no evidence to support any partial capacity that the judge may have found under these circumstances?
The judge only made a finding of incapacity. There was no finding of partial or total. We did request additional findings. They were not acted upon.
Was that one of the additional findings you requested?
It is.
And it was not acted
upon? It was not acted upon, yes. We did make that additional request for findings.
But have I accurately described your position that she is in fact totally incapacitated and that the only evidence in the record is that she's totally incapacitated?
Yes, I believe that is correct, that based on the evidence that there is nothing that she's able to do for herself. So based on the statutory definition of incapacity, she would be somebody who would have a total guardianship and would need a total guardianship.
Okay, but my understanding is you didn't ask for a total guardianship. You've only asked for a guardianship of the person, is my understanding of your brief.
There are two types of guardianship.
Right.
There's a guardian of the person, there's a guardian of the estate. You can have a guardian of the person only, because in this case, AE doesn't have any money, there's no finances, there's no money to manage. Therefore, a guardianship of the estate is not necessary. But you could have a guardian of the person without a guardian of the estate who can be totally incapacitated. In the future, if they were to inherit money, or they'd have a reason for somebody to manage the money, they would have to go back, the guardian would have to go back and ask the court to appoint them as the guardian of the estate so they can manage some money. But you don't need to have both a guardian of the estate and a guardian of the person in order to have a total incapacity. And also the findings was she couldn't manage money, the evidence was she could not manage money, and the evidence was also that she didn't have a need, there was no money that she needed to manage because she's indigent. So I do believe that supports and services were considered. It doesn't make a lot of sense to, we look at Judge King's list, which is attached to the appendix. It has maybe 75 supports and services. It doesn't make sense to have to go to court and spend 2 or 3 days checking off every single one of these items that may be applicable, particularly when we know she can't consent to them. But that's what we had the ad litem for, and the ad litem made the conclusion that there were no supports and services that were available to AE. The other big issue in this case besides supports and services is also the denial of the court abusing its discretion by not finding that AE's rights would be protected by a guardian. Without a guardian, we've already talked about the fact that that she's going to be subject to abuse and exploitation, but also there's nobody to make medical decisions, and there's nobody to give informed consent for the treatment that AE needs. Informed consent is not just nodding your head or sitting there listening to what a doctor says is the risk and benefits. It's actually understanding what those risks and benefits are of a particular procedure. And in this case, it is uncontroverted through the court staff's testimony, through the appellee's brief, and through our brief, that there's no contest to the fact that she cannot give informed consent. Nobody has responded to that argument. I think everybody concedes that AE cannot give informed consent.
Let me ask you about that, because do we not owe deference to the trial court with regard to her findings, particularly when they relate to, if you will, a credibility finding, and that there is some evidence in the record of interaction between the judge herself and AE, and the court making certain findings with regard to that interaction, reaching certain conclusions herself with regard to that, that seemed to be the basis for her ruling in that regard, that she thought, based upon her interaction with AE, that AE could make some basic decisions.
The court made, particularly its number of findings 11, 12, and 14 that the court made, and specifically the court made a finding that AE moved her head up to essentially say yes to an answer. When AE was asked a question, again, the questions were all phrased as essentially a yes or no answer. She would answer yes, as the testimony was, that's what she always does. So when the judge made a statement on the record, let the record reflect that AE appears to be shaking her head shaking her head up and down to indicate that she agrees. The judge also made a finding that she did not shake her head, and there was silence on the record when she did not agree. However, there's nothing in the record that supports that. The judge did not make that finding on the record. If that was the case, the judge should have said, let the record reflect the ward is not answering the question, or let the record reflect the ward is shaking her head no. There's nothing in the record that supports that. And in fact, the record supports the opposite, which is she's unable to communicate. The court's own court investigator testified that she does not understand the significance of the decisions that she's making. She doesn't understand the answers to the questions that are being asked of her. So I don't believe there's any facts in the record that supports that court's conclusion that somehow she meaningfully participated in the hearing.
Okay. Mine's a different question. Okay. How are we to make that determination without substituting ourselves into the fact finder position? And do you have any authority that would guide us with regard to that?
Well, I think when the judge makes a decision and makes a finding of fact or a conclusion, that finding has to be supported somewhere in the record, and it's not. You know, I don't believe a judge can.
I think the problem in these cases with the legislature's changes in 2015, no longer is the default position that a guardian is appointed. And you make a lot of strong arguments in your briefing to this court that because this was uncontested, that we should give strong consideration to reversing the judge's decision in this case. However, the judge also has a separate statutory duty to consider whether a guardian would be appointed, even if it is uncontested under the current statute, and she has to consider whether there is clear and convincing evidence to support the request. So it seems like the judge is in a difficult position here.
I believe the evidence is more than clear and convincing that AE in this case needed a guardian.
Should each time that a probate judge is given an uncontested request for guardianship, should they grant the guardianship?
I believe that if the evidence supports the guardianship, which it did in this case, yes, I believe they should be granted the guardianship. I don't believe the judge is in a position to just decide a party has met the statutory elements, has put on the necessary proof, and completely ignore the facts of the case, which is more or less what kind of happened in this case, particularly with the findings that were made, as they're not supported in the record. So in answer to the question, how do you substitute? You're not. Because you're only looking at what the evidence was. We have to look at the findings the judge made. We did ask those findings to be amended because they were not correct, and the judge did not act on them. So we asked.
Follow-up, do we have to send this back to the judge to make follow-up findings? Or what are you asking us to do, and tell me why that's justified?
I think there's a couple of things that this court can do. Obviously, we think we've met the elements. We think the guardianship should have been granted, and we believe the court can send it back and say order a guardianship put in place and appoint the PE and HE as the guardian. We think that's one option. If the court doesn't feel they can do that, then I think the court can still send it back with an opinion that says we believe the guardianships is necessary based on these findings, and go ahead and have the trial court have to consider those and then reconsider based on the court's decision here about the necessity for the guardianship. But I believe all the elements were met, and I believe the court should have granted a guardianship in this case.
But for us to do that, we have to literally find that the evidence supported a firm conviction despite the fact that the trial court did not feel that firm conviction.
I think what this court would be saying is that the evidence overwhelmingly supports the guardianship, and the judge abused her discretion by not looking at the evidence and essentially ignoring the evidence and substituting her own judgment for what the evidence otherwise showed.
Thank you. I believe your time has expired. If you'd add 2 minutes to Ms. Barkley's time, please.
May it please the court. My name is Mary Barkley, and I'm here as appointed ad litem appellate counsel for AE, in which my role is to determine whether appellants met their burden on appeal to show an abuse of discretion. Guardianship is based on the concept that the court and the officer of the court, the attorney ad litem, must seek any less restrictive alternatives to full guardianship, which was all that was requested here, if they exist and if they are applicable. The attorney ad litem is to, per the Appendix C, Judge King's paper, which appellants have also cited, is to hold the applicants for guardianship to their burden of proof. Here on appeal, the burden of proof to justify a reversal is an abuse of discretion. It's clear in this case that the parents of AE are loving parents who have the best interests of their child at heart, and that they filed the underlying application, and that AE is, quote, in response to Justice Birdwell's question, legally incapacitated. There was no evidence on whether she was, well, there was no discussion of parsing that between is she partially incapacitated, other than the court investigator's testimony here, which in which she said that AE was capable of making some decisions with her parents' assistance, and that she'd been doing so for a period of time, and that there was no urgency, that there was no problem that she was facing.
Do you agree that, or contest that, the doctor who testified that she was totally incapacitated?
I believe yes, that's the testimony from the doctor. There's I think a concession by the court investigator that she was incapacitated. I don't believe she used the term totally incapacitated.
So the only expert testimony, the uncontroverted expert testimony, was that she was totally incapacitated.
The testimony from the medical professional, yes, is that she was totally incapacitated and incapable of making informed consent for medical decisions.
And the investigator did not testify that she was capable of making informed consent for medical conditions, did she?
That's correct. She instead stated that she could make some decisions with her parents' assistance. And so when you get to the 2015 changes to the guardianship law here, it makes this case a little bit more difficult.
Okay. Let's assume that we affirm, okay? A month from now, she's assisted by her parents to go to the doctor because she's not feeling well. They find a spot on her kidney, okay? Doctor recommends, after the examination, a biopsy of the spot. Walk me through how that interchange between the doctor and A&E is going to be what constitutes informed consent under the Medical Liability and Insurance Improvement Act.
I think there are definite issues there, Justice Birdwell. I think that, and that's been raised by the Cook Children's amicus brief here. I think the informed consent issue, and after having read that and more details on the informed consent issue that was filed on Monday, I supplemented my brief, asked for leave of court to do so, this court consider remand for purposes of.
Well, then let's look at what was actually said in the trial court, okay? What was meant in the trial court by the investigator with assistance, okay? Because what it looks like is the doctor, A&E, parents in the room, doctor says, I think you need this treatment. A&E is just kind of a vessel through which communication is occurring with the parents. The parents say, we think you should agree to this. She says yes, because that's what she always does, which is what the record reflects. And so the doctor gets that. The problem is if one of the risks that's associated with that procedure occurs, the parents, the A&E or a next friend representing A&E can then argue that she didn't have the capacity to actually agree to that, didn't understand that was a risk of the procedure. And the doctor has legal liability potentially for going forward with the procedure simply based upon the assurances of the parents that they suggested that the treatment be done. There's an issue, it appears, with accountability that the healthcare providers can rely on.
I fully recognize that issue, and I think that if this court is inclined to hold that the establishment of the legal incapacity, which is one element out of five necessary to establish a guardianship now in the state based on the 2015 statute, that if that finding is enough to knock out the D&E requirements, the new requirements, that the case can be remanded for consideration of a limited guardianship based on those instructions. Because I
think you've hit on what the problem that Judge Birdwell and also Judge Gabriel have hit on in their questioning is we have a finding here of incapacity. And in the judge making that finding, is that are we stuck with that finding? She made a finding, there's a finding of incapacity here. Is that the equivalent of a total incapacity? Because it seems like she said we have a finding here by the court that this individual is incapacitated, which under a legal definition would seem to preclude this person being able to give informed consent to medical care.
I think that it's unclear based on this record whether that finding means total or partial, or whether even a partial finding was requested. I think a partial finding of incapacity is supported by the record based on the court investigator's testimony.
Well, and that's why I'm asking the question I am about what does it mean with assistance of the parents? Okay, that's incredible. That there's a range there. Okay, are they effectively making the decision by suggestion, or are they just being consulted briefly by somebody who has the capacity, or at least some partial capacity, to substantively address a medical condition that needs treatment of some type?
And that's
what I'm trying to figure out. Because, you know, again, we're not in a position to substitute our judgment for that of the trial court, but at the same time, there are legal realities as to what is required for legal informed consent that this record doesn't appear to provide a basis for us concluding she can give.
Well,
because the private investigator actually agreed she didn't really understand.
And that's true, and the record is not well developed on what the court investigator meant when she said she could make some decisions with her parents' assistance.
Would it have been within the authority of the trial court to have ordered an independent medical examination if the trial court had an issue with regard to that, and was that discussed, or is that something that might be something that can be used here to make sure that we're dealing with total incapacity, or we have a comfort level as far as the trial court is concerned as to the degree of incapacity if it's not total?
I believe that the trial court would have had authority to ask perhaps the ad litem to order additional evaluations in the trial level. Yes.
And is that a recommendation that maybe the private investigator could have made at that point in time? And that's not saying that they should have. Right now, since this is a case of first impression, I'm trying to figure out exactly how we look at this from a parameter standpoint.
I think that's possible, that the court investigator could have asked for that. This whole case.
Agree that the court investigator stated that based upon the record heard in the trial court, she could not disagree that guardianship was what should be ordered.
Actually, I disagree with that. I think there's a portion of the record at page 34 to 35 where the court investigator testified as follows. She stated, when I met with the family, we talked about what kind of problems they were running into. She's been 18 for 2 weeks, and there weren't any problems that they had run into the day I was out there and met with them. And so there was nothing I could indicate was a reason that they needed to be the legal guardian. As her parents, they were able to take care of getting her to the doctor. They provide food and clothing and shelter. They're interacting with the school. She has one more year of high school. I just didn't see anything currently that would require guardianship. That's from the hearing. And that goes to the supports and services, which are supposed to be evaluated as part of the guardianship statute, the new guardianship statute, 101 or 1101-101A1E. So D and E are the new requirements. And that includes, which is part of the new statute as well, Estates Code 1002.0031 states that there are four statutory supports and services that should be considered available informal and formal resources and assistance that enable an individual to meet the individual's needs for food, clothing, and shelter, to care for the individual's physical or mental health, to manage the individual's financial affairs, to make personal decisions regarding residence, voting, operating a motor vehicle, etc. And I think what we have here is perhaps the evidence from the doctor knocks out one of those available supports and services, the care for individual physical and mental health, but the other supports and services might be able to be met. And I think this may be.
Didn't the court find she was incapable of driving and voting and doing those other things?
I believe the evidence was that she was incapable of doing that. And I don't think, but on the other making decisions regarding residence, I think that's what the court investigator was discussing when she said she could make decisions with her parents' assistance.
So would you concede that the judge here should have at least imposed a limited guardianship based on those findings?
I think that a limited guardianship would have been justified by this record. However, the question here is whether the court abused its discretion in declining to impose a full guardianship based on the record.
And but isn't it part of the judge's job under the new 2015 law that was put into place that if they don't consider a full guardianship and some type of guardianship is needed, they do need to consider a limited guardianship?
1101-152 says if it is found that the proposed ward lacks the capacity to do some, but if not all, of the tasks necessary to care for himself or herself, with or without supports and services, the court may appoint a guardian with limited powers. And that wasn't necessarily raised here.
I agree with what you just read, and I also look at 1001.00B, where it says, the law requires courts to design a guardianship to encourage the development or maintenance of maximum self-reliance and independence of the incapacitated person. So here we have these findings, that this individual is incapacitated. We have other findings that this individual can't perform certain tasks, and we have a denial of any type of guardianship, period. That's why I ask you, do you concede that under the facts of this case that are uncontested and undisputed, that the judge should have at a minimum appointed a limited guardianship over this individual?
I think that the facts would support a limited guardianship.
So that's a yes, Ms. Barkley?
I think that our limited standard of review, that the abuse of discretion, was there some probative evidence, any at all, to support the trial court's denial of the full guardianship which was requested? I think the answer is that there was some. We may not like the decision now, but the trial court was in the position to judge the credibility and demeanor of the witnesses, which included the proposed ward who testified. And here, I think the trial court could have gone either
way.
She's
incapacitated. How does she have the competence to testify?
Well, that I think that the court could have weighed the incapacity in light of her testimony.
You don't think that's an abuse of discretion? To take that testimony, if it is testimony, that's worthy of any weight over a doctor?
I think if it were just the testimony of AE, then I agree. It would be a complete abuse of discretion. But we've also got the court investigator's opinion here that refutes two of the five required standards for guardianship. And if the legal capacity or incapacity finding is all that's required to knock out D and E, the new parts of the statute required by the 2015 legislature, then why did they add those two? The legislative history, it shows that the legislature wanted to make guardianships a last resort. And in this case, that's the reason I think that the court investigator ultimately concluded that guardianship wasn't warranted. However, in light of the record, which is pretty limited, if this court is not inclined to affirm, we would ask that it be remanded to the trial court with instructions on how to apply this statute, and since this is a case of first impression. So, thank you all for your time.
Thank you. Sorry. No,
I have another question.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Dubner, I want to ask you right off the bat, what is it you are asking this court to do specifically? You've heard her now say, if we're not inclined to affirm, remand for consideration of a limited guardianship. You're not asking for a reverse and render. You're asking for a reverse and remand as well, correct?
If the court believes it has the discretion to reverse and render, yes. I believe the court should do that. If the court believes it does not have the ability to actually render a decision to actually appoint my clients as the guardian, then I believe the court should send it back with basically a very tight opinion that forces the judge to grant a total guardianship, because that's what the evidence supported. The counsel brought up that there's a limited guardianship, and she read the statute that says they can't do all, but they can do some things. In this case, the testimony was she can't do anything, which fits the definition of a total guardianship, a full guardianship with guardians being appointed with full authority. I also want to go back and address the allegation where she read from the record on page 34 that supports that the court investigator said there were supports and services that were available. That line of questioning was from the court, from the judge. Upon cross-examination by myself, the court investigator actually changed her story on page 36 of the record and said that they can't. If the child can't see the doctor, then supports and services don't work. She also made a change to her recommendation that the alternatives to guardianship also do not work. So the court investigator made those changes to her report and recommended to the judge at the end that the judge should grant a guardianship, which the judge ignored. There was a lot of questions about can AE make the decisions with the parents' assistance. I believe the testimony from the court investigator is basically AE's along for the ride. She's just not even an active participant. She's just sitting there, just like Justice Birdwell said. She's going to nod her head but not have a clue what it is she's consenting to. And again, it goes to just more than just medical. We're talking educational here, because we have the same standard under federal law that says all the rights transfer to the child, and she has to give that consent, which she doesn't have the ability to do.
So how are we to facilitate what the clear intent of the legislature is with regard to these matters, okay? If parents come in with treating physician who they've been working with, I mean, there is a credibility issue there, okay? This is someone who they've been working with for a long time, and may have an interest in providing the testimony that they need for purposes of the guardianship, okay? I agree with Justice Pittman that the judge has an independent duty to make sure that the guardianship is required and that the facts support that. How is a judge to make that determination? Is an IME appropriate under the circumstances to make sure that the medical testimony that the judge is getting is actually uncontroverted and not subject to some type of prior interest beforehand?
Any party could have requested an IME. Nobody requested an IME because the parties, including the original ad litem who handled it at the trial court, believed that the IME was good, or excuse me, the doctor's form letter that was submitted was accurate and represented what was AE's real condition. There wasn't a need to have somebody else go out and do their own examination to report back as to whether this doctor's form letter is sufficient or not. You typically would only use an IME in a case where maybe the ward or the individual is the one contesting and saying, I don't need a guardian. That wasn't the case in this. This AE didn't have that ability to say, I don't want this, and therefore I don't.
I agree that would be available for a court to order if there was good cause to make that inquiry, just to make sure of what the medical evidence is.
I believe that if there was a question about whether that medical evidence was sufficient, I believe it could have been ordered, absolutely. And I believe the court could have done it sua sponte if the court believed the IME was not correct. But there was no testimony contrary to what the physician said. And in fact, I still believe that the court investigator's testimony is consistent with what the doctor said. Now, to get there, you have to read beyond the judge's questions of the court investigator. You have to get to the cross-examination of the court investigator where she actually changed and actually agreed. So there is no disagreement, in my opinion, about
that. Did she make a verbal recommendation to the court that supported the guardianship on the record?
Yes. At the end of the transcript, she did say that if, based on the facts that she heard, that she would have to change her written report and recommend the guardianship.
Judge Gable, if I may, can I ask one last question?
Sure.
Mr. Dubner, if you can't tell from our questioning, this is certainly a very difficult case in many respects. It's a case of first impression. The ad litem filed a motion for leave to file a supplemental brief this morning, which I noticed that you have not consented to. Given the special nature of this case, are you going to continue to oppose that motion? Don't we want to have all the information that we can as a court to consider when we make a case of first impression?
The reason that I would not consent to the brief is because there was the amicus brief filed by Cook's Children's.
Last night.
It was filed on
yesterday?
Monday. Filed Monday.
Okay.
So the brief filed by Cook's Children's basically piggybacked my briefs, both my initial and my reply brief. Other than raising a new issue about constitutionality and raising another issue about HIPAA, which we did not address, the arguments were basically the same. And I believe the appellate rules give the appellant the opportunity to have the last response and not give the appellee a chance to go back and correct their brief.
I'm not asking about the appellate rules. I'm asking as a lawyer in our duties under the bar and the Texas Lawyers Creed, and in a case like this dealing with an individual's rights, it would seem to me an issue of first impression. The court would want to have all the information it could in front of it before it issued a decision. That's what I'm asking about. I appreciate it. Thanks.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much for your briefing and for your arguments here today. As Judge Pittman just said, this, you know, we had a lot of questions, and we appreciate you trying to deal with them. Your case is submitted, and you are excused, and we will adjourn.
Thank you.